Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week I'm joined by one of the UK's finest actors. From beginnings in EastEnders, he's gone on to work with some of the biggest filmmakers in the world, as well as appearing in some of TV's most iconic shows.
Those parts where you're at the foot of a mountain and you're like, there's no way I can possibly take that on. But when you commit to it and you scale the mountain and it comes out like gold, it's such a precious thing to have.
Sitting down with me in the illustrious surroundings of the Savoy for this episode is the hugely talented Daniel Mays. Now, just before we dive in, we're enjoying a glass of Laurent Perrier Heritage today. This is their newest offering, but I want to tell you about a bold move that shaped champagne a long time ago. Back in 1889, Mathilde Emily Perrier was steering Laurent Perrier into a new age. She was the house's first female owner, and she had an idea. A new champagne, which would be called Grand Vin sans sucre. As the name suggests, this would contain no added sugar whatsoever. What would be produced was a perfectly dry wine. This bold move wasn't just ahead of its time, it was designed for those who appreciated something different and perfectly suited to the sensibilities of British customers. Grand Vin sans sucre represents the fearless innovation that still defines Laurent Perrier today. So, here's to breaking tradition and savouring something extraordinary.
Daniel Mays, here's to you.
Cheers.
A true Savoy original.
There you go.
Lovely to have you.
I love your get-up, by the way, Alex. You're looking spruced up. $1 million, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's very kind. You look very good yourself as well. To begin, I'd like to go back to the beginning. Do you think there is a quality you learned about yourself early in life that has stayed with you and maybe even shaped the way you've approached everything you do?
Where can we begin? I mean, I'm one of four boys.
Yeah.
If anyone's a middle child like me, it was a case of really trying. Like, my two older brothers and my younger brother were fantastic sportsmen. We were all mad football players, tennis, cricket, all that stuff. I played all of those sports as well, but I was just never as good as my two older brothers were. So it's that thing of desperately trying to find a different outlet in order to be noticed within that family unit, I think. Performing was something that came just very naturally to me. I always remember doing impressions of teachers at school and all that sort of stuff, and of various celebrities. It used to be a kind of a bit of a party piece. And my mum and dad were incredibly gregarious people. We always used to have huge group of like family friends that when we went away on holiday, it wasn't just us as a family, it was us and all of their mates. So I was always sort of doing impressions to crowd of people in a room, yeah, from a very early age.
So when you decided that performing was going to be your thing, how did your three brothers react to that news?
they've all kind of been very supportive, really. Look, the first light bulb moment for me, the first performance I ever saw that really was my light bulb moment, was Michael Jackson in the Bad Tour in 1988, and my mum, I'd been given the CD and the VHS, well, it was a cassette, not a CD, and I was just obsessed by his music, him as a performer, and then my mum was able to bag two tickets for the show at Wembley. So I was about 13. I'd never been in a sea of people like that, and then he came out and he just performed. It was the dancing. The dancing and the music, but specifically the dancing. And I remember being that young thinking, that's what I want to do. Like, it's so ingrained in my brain. I remember travelling back on the tube and they were selling like T-shirts and posters of him and things like that. That became my party piece. Like, I would lock myself in my bedroom and I got the white towel in socks and the black fedora hat. And I went all out, the white strip down the trousers. And that became my thing to do. So any school disco, if that track came on, if it was Billie Jean or Beat It or whatever it was, everyone would form a circle because they knew that Danny was going to go into his routine. I still do it now at weddings and bar mitzvahs. And no. So that was, in terms of like where it all began, that was it.
That was the moment.
Yeah.
So you joined the Italia Conti school at 13 years old.
Yeah.
We actually had a guest on who talked about being unable to follow their dream to join a London stage school because of the cost. Was that a factor that you had to consider?
Yes. I mean, my sort of MJ routine, that led to a local dance group called Stage One in Loughton in Essex. And it was a great teacher there, Caroline Hurst, who's still a dear friend now. I remember she had gone to Sylvia Young's as a kid. And she could see that I was enthusiastic for it. I had a passion for it. I had a talent for it. And she was the one that really put the seed in my mind or my mum's mind to say, you know, what about sending him to stage school? Like, that is the sort of natural next step. I remember I auditioned for Sylvia's Raven's Court, as I remember, and then Italia Conti, yeah. I auditioned for it, and I got in the second year of senior school, and I didn't go. I chickened out because it was... I was at West Hatch High School in Chigwell. It was like a normal comprehensive. And I just, there was this fear of the whole psychological shift of leaving, you know, your life in Essex, going all the way up on the Central Line as a sort of 13-year-old and putting on the blue uniform. And it was a completely 180-degree spin in life. And for a kid of 13, that was too much for my young head to get. And I chickened out and I said, I'm not going to go. But it was an itch I continued to scratch. And I auditioned the following year and we decided to do it. So yeah, the third year of senior school, I was up there, like, yeah, 14 years of age. And I do remember I got a government grant. Along with that, my mum and dad did contribute some of the money. I mean, my dad's an electrician. To this day, he's an electrician. My mum works as a bank cashier. But she also did a second job in a factory, in a box factory, in order to scrimp and save to get
To help you to...
Yeah, to pay the school fees by working two jobs. I never forgot that. You know, an amazing gesture from her. So people say to me, Danny, you don't stop working. You've got a really intense work ethic. Without a shadow of a doubt, it comes from my parents, particularly my dad. I guess it's that working class mentality of... You're only as good as your last job and you have to keep plugging away as such.
I mean, it's fair to say a lot of our British acting exports, not all of them, but a lot, do come from a background that has helped them enter that career, whether or not it's money and they can enter what is fundamentally a risky profession.
Yeah.
A lot of them perhaps have relatives who work in that industry and that helps them into it. You've obviously gone on to huge success without having that helping hand, that privilege. Was that ever on your mind as you pursued the career?
Yeah, the whole thing was completely alien to me. It was the complete unknown. You know, you kind of, you jump into it and it's either sink or swim, really. Even to this day, though, I still feel like I'm trying in some capacity to prove myself. You know, it seems that there are certain elements of my industry that who are celebrated more than others. You know, that always seems to be... The whole working class debate compared to kids that have been, you know, educated through uni and all that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. sort of born with a silver spoon in your mouth. That, you know, contemporaries of mine, people that like sort of Steve Graham and Eddie Marzan, I think we're always fighting that fight. You can't rest on your laurels, you know, it forces you to turn up and produce the goods again and again.
When you look back over your childhood, was there one thing, could you put... Like a nail on the one thing that really drove you and motivated you?
I'm lucky in that I've found the profession which I get incredible satisfaction from. You know, it's you know, acting is such a huge, without sounding completely pretentious, it's not just a job, really. It's sort of part of your DNA. It's sort of like this kind of want and need to act, to perform, or whatever it is. It's that sort of artistic streak that all artists have in themselves where you go, you have to create something. You have to, it's about really a form of self-expression, isn't it? Which is the thing that drives me. I'm in terms of an art form, acting to me is totally mysterious and it gets even more mysterious the older you get. It's about really a form of self-expression, isn't it? I was very astute in making the decision that an actor's life can go on and on, as opposed to say, like, I mean, I originally wanted to be a footballer, but, you know, that has a shelf life. A dancer's life has a shelf life. Acting is ever mysterious and can sort of consume you. And I think you get better as you go along with it. You gain more and more experience. And I guess the fear factor of, you know, stepping in front of an audience or being in front of a camera, that sort of diminishes. And you try and hone your craft as best you can. Yeah. I've always been someone that doesn't rest on their last performance. And I think it's a thing of, I'm very passionate about once, this does sound pretentious, but I'm passionate about leaving a legacy. Do you know what I mean? It's important to me when I'm sitting in the actor's retirement home, Denville Hall, I want to look back and think, you know, I've got a body of work which I'm really proud of.
Well, I want to talk about some of this body of work and these experiences that you've brought to the screen. There are so many people who try and forge a career in acting, yeah, and it just simply doesn't happen for them. But why do you think you've succeeded?
That's $1 million question, isn't it? I had a great acting teacher at RADA, a wonderful woman called Dee Cannon, sadly no longer with us. She was my first serious acting teacher there, amazing with me. You know, because I came from Conses and it was all kind of like tits and teeth from the outside in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I always remember her saying to me, a great actor is an actor who risks. And I never forgot that. And that basically comes down to the choices that you make. Because like when you leave drama school, you stick your head above the parapet and people put you in a pigeonhole, really. And I'm Danny from Essex. The headmaster at RADA, Nick Barter, said, don't worry, Danny, when you leave your work, you'll play young men on the edge. And he was absolutely right. So I played a lot of, you know, gangsters and criminals and bank robbers. But I think the longer you then stay in it, slowly but surely, then opportunities will come your way in terms of trying to stretch yourself as an actor. And I always remember there was a moment when I got cast in... Sky did an adaptation of Treasure Island.
Oh, yes.
And Steve Barron, who actually directed Michael Jackson's Billie Jean video, by the way. All I did was talking to him about that video the whole time. But he cast me as the posh doctor, Dr. Livesey.
Uh-huh.
It was like those types of roles started to open up. So it's about wanting to stretch yourself as a performer. Is it an accent you haven't attempted before? Is it a director you've never worked with? Is it a period piece? You know, you need to try and test an audience's perception of what a working class actor is capable of.
So you've consciously put in a lot of effort to not be typecast in those men on the edge roles.
Yeah, and what I found is those you'll always get parts like that. And I'm never afraid to say if it is a young guy a middle-aged guy now that's on the edge that speaks with a London accent, that's something that plays to your strengths and you can go for it. But then when you get something like, I mean, I did a one-off drama called Against the Law, where I played Peter Wildblood, which is a true story about a gay journalist in the 50s who got imprisoned for being gay in the 50s. And there was lots of bedroom scenes, shall we say, a lot of intimate scenes with the great Richard Gadd, who went on to do Baby Reindeer. So we played lovers in it. I remember thinking to myself, that's such a polar opposite to what I get cast as. There was part of me which was so scared about doing it and committing to it. And my wife was like, that's exactly the reason why you should say yes to that project. And to this day, it's probably the most proud of any role I've taken on.
And so, and at what point do you go, that was the right decision? When do you sit and you watch it? Do you know on set, are you watching the rushes? Are you feeling something in the room in the moment?
I think you can, genuinely, you can feel that there's something happening in the room. Do you know what I mean? It's like this sort of intangible essence on set or the feeling that you're getting from a crew, just how you feel the role is going. As the brilliant Sir Ben Kingsley said to me recently, was preparation, preparation, preparation wins the war. So if it comes to like a really challenging role, do your prep work, do the script work, do the accent work, do whatever sort of research you have to do. So it gets you to the point where you step on set and you can literally just forget about it all. And it's so ingrained in you and you can just go and play. That's the biggest job I can do, really, is that. But then there are the things also where you that you feel like you're going really well, and when they come out, it just doesn't work.
Right.
So again, you can't ever predict it. I mean, the final factor is always how it's going to go down with an audience.
Yeah.
So that's the last component. And sometimes you've been in stuff where you think this is going to be great, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't connect.
And how do you then judge that? Obviously, if it hasn't been a success, are you still able to watch your performance and go, well, I did the best work I could have done within that project?
Totally, yeah. Yeah, because to me, like a film or a TV show is like a, it's like taking a photograph. It's like a frozen moment in time. But when you film something, it's fleeting. So you have to deliver day in, day out. And yeah, you can't really afford to be off it. Do you know what I mean?
And I imagine you can ask, you can go, look, can I take that again? Or are there two?
Oh, yeah.
You can get multiple tries. Because some directors, you know, don't often let that happen. It's like, no, if I've got what I want, regardless of how you feel as the actor, we're moving on.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, the greatest directors are the ones that it's such a collaborative effort together. You know, it's... I mean, I can't remember, there must have been, but if I go, look, I want to do another one, or I love it when a director comes up to me and says, Danny, we've got that. Just do one for fun. Just do one, whatever that comes into your head.
Oh, maybe even improvise. Now, I asked that specifically because I think I read somewhere that improvisation was something that really changed your approach and allowed you to push yourself into some an unexpected and quite raw places. I'm fascinated by how you basically get to that point on a set.
Yeah, I remember doing an improvisation when I was really young at Italia Conte. I think you might be referencing that. I remember I had this weird sort of improvisation where I was playing a rent boy and you had to sort of explode in some capacity. And I remember in this class just picking up a chair and throwing it against the wall and just kind of going crazy and everyone just sitting there dumbstruck by what I did. But this teacher was like, that's it. This is, you know what I mean? It's about to whip yourself up into a frenzy of anger on set is quite easy for me. But you've got to be safe, though. That's the way. You know, I've worked with some actors that are not safe and it's like, that's great, but, you know, we've got to do another 7 takes from different angles and you've pretty much broken my arm. So, you know, that's like... along with the raw talent that you have to hone that with technique. And that's what I got from places like Italia Conti. And I mean, I joked earlier about tits and teeth and stuff like that, but what I think Italia Conti gave me as a performer was this immense understanding of physicality, because we did a lot of jazz, ballet, tap and everything. Particularly on stage, I've always tended to be very... the physicality of a character is really like a key component to me.
And when you go to quite a raw or vulnerable place, does it ever feel exposing to have people witnessing that, or is it like I've unlocked a great achievement here?
Exposing is the key word. Yeah, I mean, it's if you're doing something incredibly emotional, you have to. I mean, I often use lots of music and emotional recall. Lots of actors do that. You'll see if I've got to do an emotional scene for that day, I'll be sitting in the corner listening to whatever and then just trying to get into the headspace. That all comes from the work I did with Mike Lee, you know, because when you work with Mike, if he tells you to get in character, you get in character and you don't come out until someone tells you to come out of character, whether that be Mike himself or one of his assistants. So he could tell you to get into character like hours before you actually come and do the improvisation or indeed shoot a scene in the movie. So that tendency of keeping it on a low light but being in character comes from working with him. And it's, in a way, it's a weird sort of thing of if you're in character for that length of time, you are sort of so in it, you know, you're sort of enveloped in the character and the emotion of the piece, and then it all comes out. But it's exposing, yeah. You've got to cry in front of a room full of people and people... that's always the thing, like everyone in the room has to be on the same page, pulling in the same direction, read the script, know that this particular scene this day is full of emotion and it's got sensitivity in it. And it's about them as a crew being understanding of how intricate and delicate this particular scene, you know, is.
And it was All or Nothing. That was the first time you worked with Mike Lee. And then obviously...
yeah, that character was full of rage. There was a few broken chairs in that film as well.
So, I mean, because it's Mike Lee, I mean, like these characters that you're required to be in, like for that length of time, quite hard characters.
Yeah.
Just what is that like? Like, how easy is it to maintain that for that length of time? And what is the release like at the end when Mike finally says, do you know what? Now come out of character.
Yeah, well, the famous Mike Leigh story with me was working on Vera Drake. It's such a unique working experience with him. The thing about Mike's work is you only ever talk about the character with Mike. You only know what your character knows. But something like Vera Drake, I can remember feels like bizarre saying it now, but I can remember getting into character as 6 months old as my character in Vera Drake. And they said, right, you're 6 months old. Like, I literally, on a big piece of carpet, like, get into character. And then we move up through the ages. And then you get introduced to the other actors and you do like a hand improviser. I'm giving away all of your secrets now, but who cares? And then we rehearsed Vera Drake in Crouch End for 6 months. I mean, on any movie, that's completely unheard of. You haven't even shot anything yet. You're just existing as this family in the 1950s. So Phil Davis is my dad, Imelda Staunton's my mum, Alex Kelly's my sister. And we would just improvise over and over and over. And I was like, we're like 5 months into this. I know my character, like I know the family, like what's happened? Like, and I started to panic. What's going on? And then it might have been a week later where we came to improvise the engagement party scene. And we were cooking the food, we laid the table, guests arrived, auntie, uncle, we're sitting around, Mike's sitting in the corner of the room, perched there just watching. This is going on for hours. Then all of a sudden there's this knock on the door. No one's saying come out of character. Phil goes over and then all of a sudden the police pile in. What's going on here? Like there's part of your brain that goes, oh my God, there's police, what's happening? Does Vera Drake live here? They go and interrogate Vera Drake all evening. And we are literally locked in this flat smoking woodbines going, what on earth is going on? It's like we've been there maybe 7-8 hours, still in character. And then the door goes again and Phil Davis comes back, who's playing my dad, and he sits us down and he says, I've got to tell you something. He goes, she's obviously a backstreet abortionist. She's been helping young girls out. And honestly, it was like a physical, I can remember it to this day, it's like my stomach fell away. Everything was just ripped apart. Do you know what I mean? It's all of the research, all of that history, all of that effort, and we were in tears. And I had to get out of this room. And there was this weird sort of wasteland at the back of this disused hospital. And I was literally in these woods. I'm still in character. I've been in character for about 10 hours. I kid you not. And it was really windy and rainy and things like that. And all of a sudden, I hear this on these twigs. And it was Mike Leigh. And he comes and he just edges himself next to me. And he comes up to me and he goes, come out of character. It was like we'd all been hypnotized. It was the weird, to this day, it was the most incredible acting experience. So you are never allowed to talk to any other actor about what you've just experienced. Imelda knew that she was an abortionist. I just thought she was my loving mum who did cleaning on the side. I had no idea. And she was the only one that was in on it. And so when you come to actually film those scenes, it's so, the only way I can describe it, it's just so vividly in your head, you know, it's just part of you. So when you see all of those performances throughout his movies, the reason why they stand out and are so terrific to watch and so emotionally moving is it comes from such an organic place. You know, it's blood, sweat and tears every step of the way.
Now, as we sip this Laurent Perrier Héritage, I'm struck by how their bold choices continue to inspire. Earlier, I told you about how Grand Vin Sans Sucre made waves way back in 1889. Fast forward to 1981, and Bernard de Nonancourt was experimenting again with dry champagnes. Following in Mathilde Emily Perrier's footsteps, he created Laurent Perrier Ultra Brut, a champagne with zero sugar, but refined with crispness, elegance, and purity.
In many ways, Ultra Brut can be thought of as a testament to Laurent Perrier's devotion to innovation and refinement, but also a modern evolution of a daring creation bottled nearly a century before. And so, a toast to those who dare to innovate, to the people and ideas that have made champagne what it is today. Let's enjoy it responsibly.
And obviously, with Mike Lee, that's a very unique experience. But to put Mike Lee to one side, you've worked with a real who's who of filmmaking talent, from Joe Wright on Atonement, to Ridley Scott on A Good Year, Sam Mendes on 1917, Steven Spielberg on Tintin.
Where are they now?
Was there someone from that list whose working style surprised you? I only ask because I was talking to someone about Ridley Scott, who worked with him as an actor, and they were like, he's just not really an actor's director. He just expects you to turn up, know your stuff, be prepared so he can focus on every other element of the shot.
I mean, all those guys you listed were just extraordinary. I think what they all have in common is that they allowed you to feel an important component of the overall film, even though something like, I mean, I'm thinking of Joe Wright, actually, on Atonement. I played Tommy Nettle, the guy that was with James McAvoy's character all the way to the end of his life. You know, it's a small kind of support part, but I remember him giving me a very long speech. He said, meet me, we're all staying in the same, it's like a road movie, Atonement. And he said, meet me in that hotel bar before breakfast. And he gave me this monologue and he went, I need you to learn that. Anthony Minghella wrote that monologue. Can you believe that?
Really?
And he said, this is a speech that Anthony Minghella's written for you. You need to learn it in the next couple of hours. That's the first scene up. That character, because he was so nervous about being in warfare, he just didn't stop talking. And I was like, oh my God. But it made the movie. It's a very funny speech, if I do say so myself. But I was just so relieved that I was managed to get through it without screwing the lines up. Joe Wright was a great director in that he allowed you into the, I mean, the most incredible scene I've ever been involved in is the Steadicam shot in Atonement, where they recreated Dunkirk on Redcar Beach, and he did it in one Steadicam shot. And there's like literally 1,000 extras all dressed up in World War One get up, and it was like I'd never seen such a sea of people. And it was so meticulously rehearsed, that sequence. There was like pockets of different ADs working with 20 soldiers. But the thing that did surprise me about Joe, and there's just how utterly calm and collected he was in that. I remember watching him going, this guy was absolutely born to do this. And some people criticise that Steadicam shot and think it's a bit grandstanding. I disagree completely. I think it's one of the best Steadicam shots you're ever likely to see. So when I came to do a Steadicam shot in 1917, it was like I was a dab hand. I knew exactly what I was doing.
To mention another incredible scene, although from a TV show, and I know you and I have actually spoken about this previously, which is obviously your BAFTA-nominated performance in Line of Duty, yeah. Episode 1, Season 3, and that interview scene in the police station where your officer is being questioned about his use of force. I rewatched it ahead of this interview, and it's just such a tense scene, such an incredible scene. What was that like to shoot?
We literally shot my scene out in 2 weeks because I was about to go and do a Patrick Marber play at the National Theatre. So we were against time, which in essence actually helped performance in a way. But that particular scene was the penultimate day of filming. But when it came to a Line of Duty, that interrogation scene was part of the audition. So I auditioned for that role. I was a big fan of the first two seasons because I'm a good mate of Craig Parkinson, who played the caddy in it. We were old flatmates. And I think Craig was one of those that put my name forward for the so it was like the audition came in and it was like, the audition, you're for the new protagonist in Line of Duty. I said, this is unbelievable. I loved that show. And then they sent me the script and I read it and I got to, and I thought, oh my God, he's gunned someone down in the first three pages. What's going on here? And then before you know it, you're in a sort of 10-page interrogation scene, and it's monologue after monologue after monologue. And I'd never read anything like it. And I remember just reading this script thinking, this is just a gift. This is incredible. And the brief was, learn as much as you can of the interrogation scene. That was it. And I had like a weekend to do it. Locked myself in a room, said to Lou, do something with the kids this weekend. I've got to come, because I was going in on the Monday at like midday or whatever. And I do remember walking in and saying to Jeb Mercurio, like, first thing I said was like, well, does he make it? Like, that was my first question. And they went, no, he doesn't. It's safe to say that we're going to pull the rug and kill off the lead actor. And I was like, the lead role. And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, I did the audition, left it all in the room. That's what I always say to any young actors listening. They go, what about auditioning? I said, leave it all in the room. Don't leave the audition and go, I wish I'd said this. I wish I'd have done that. I should have known the lines better. Just do the work, leave it all in the room and forget about it. Thankfully, it came my way. But I was so ready for that. When it came to filming it, it felt like doing a piece of theatre purely because the takes were so long. So they had three cameras on me, so they shot on me first. You know that thing, they go, do you want to go first or do you want to go second? I said, I think I should probably go first, considering I've got like 10 pages of dialogue and like five monologues to get through. So we shot on me like for half the day, and then we spun round on Craig, Adrian Dunbar and Martin Compston. Adrian said, I'm going to take you out tonight. And we all went out and got royally drunk in Belfast afterwards. We had got some tapas and had a very expensive bottle of red wine, which Adrian kindly bought. But it was a big moment in my career that I got a BAFTA nomination off the back of it. But that was one of those, when you were doing it, you thought, this feels like something really special.
It was. It was. It's a wonderful scene. I wanted to ask you something that we ask all our guests, because you've created some truly memorable and unique characters over your career. So with all the experience and knowledge that you have, what do you think it takes to be original?
God, that's just such a huge question, isn't it? I think it's a question of being true to your roots. I think you have to have a real strong sense of what you have to offer. Do you understand what I mean? Like, what strengths you have as a performer in whatever field that you're working in, but have a clear and precise understanding of it. It's never a bad thing to play to your strengths, you know, and not forgetting where you've come from, but also trying to find those characters that you've never attempted before and still. I mean, I've discovered that those parts where you're at the foot of a mountain and you're like, there's no way I can possibly take that on, you know, like, your initial reaction to it is absolute fear and trepidation. I can't do this. But when you commit to it and you scale the mountain and it comes out like gold, they're the things that you hold on to. You know, it's like a sort of, it's such a precious thing to have. I mean, look, I've never done a Shakespeare production since I left drama school. So like, I did a musical recently, Guys and Dolls, which felt like going back to Italia Conti days and all that sort of stuff, and doing jazz hands at the Bridge Theatre. You know, I think I surprise a lot of people. But yeah, something like doing a Shakespeare is something really high on my agenda, really. I just feel like it's sort of a box I have to tick, you know?
And in terms of treading the boards, or the expression that you used just before we began, see you on the ice.
Yeah.
Is there something that you get from the theatre experience that TV doesn't offer you?
Yes, completely. The immediacy of performance, the adulation of the crowd. No, but do you know what I mean? It was, I mean, like I've mentioned, I used to love playing football as a kid. Doing theatre is the closest feeling I get to that again. You can't, I mean, theatre is the actor's medium. Your performance in a film and TV is shaped by the editor. You could end up on the cutting room floor, but they can really edit that performance and completely change the perception of the character. To have to sustain a character over the course of an evening and take an audience on a journey, to really have them in the palm of your hand, is there's something intangible about that. Like, if you could bottle the feelings I got when I was doing Nathan Detroit at Guys and Dolls, it was just electric. And it made me, again, it was like, can I do a musical again? Should I be doing this? But how well that show was received, it was like, it was such a union of actor and audience, very immersive the way that they staged it.
Yeah.
We used to come up into the bar afterwards and people were just like, Danny, it's the best thing I've seen in my life. Like, it was so life-affirming. So be front and center of that show and to be given an audience that amount of pleasure was, it was just like the best drug you could ever take. It was incredible.
And was there a moment when you were offered that role, was it an immediate yes, or did you have to have a conversation with yourself?
No, I had a conversation with, well, my wife was always saying, because I'm always dancing around the house, I'm always singing around the house, I'm always singing on TV sets as well. I was even singing in the Dennis Nilsson drama, Des. This is very funny footage of me. Anyway, we won't go there. She says, you've got to do a musical. And then we were on holiday in Ibiza and I had to go up to the room to get something and Lou and the kids were down at the pool. And it came on my phone. He went, this is the sort of email you want to get. You've been offered Nathan Detroit at the Bridge Theatre to be directed by Nicholas Heitner. And I was just like, this is insane. So I went down and I sat on the sun lounger and I said, you know that thing you said I should always do a musical? I went, have a look at that. And I showed him, and she went, oh, you're doing it. That was it, you're doing it. And I was still humming and ahhing and I was doing Franklin at the same time. And I was on set. I can tell you my Michael Douglas story now. I'm going to name drop, pick that one up. So I'm sitting there with Michael Douglas. He's dressed up as Benjamin Franklin and all the get up. And I'm sitting there and Noah Jupe, a brilliant young actor, says, what are you doing next, Danny? And I'm like, oh, it's a bit left field. I've been offered a musical. And Michael was like, what? What musical? And I went, Guys and Dolls. He went, Guys and Dolls? What part? And I went, Nathan Detroit. And he was like, you're doing it? And I went, Michael, I'm in two minds. He went, you're doing it, Danny. You're doing it and you're not taking no for an answer. And I was like, and then within the hour, Michael had told everyone on the crew. Tim Van Patten was the director, who's a New Yorker. His favourite, everyone's favourite musicals, Guys and Dolls, or everyone from New York, it seems to be. And so then from that point on, every time I turned up on set, dressed in a ginger wig and frock coat and heels, Tim Van Patten used to put The Oldest Establishment on his thing. And all of the French crew kept saying, it's good old reliable Nathan. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got to do this now. But they all, Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas came to see the show.
Oh, really?
So it all came full. I mean, the amount of faces that came to watch, guys, and that's the thing. Like, you knew it was something because all these sort of A-listers started turning up. Tim Robbins came to see it three times. I worked with Tim years ago. It was the night of my birthday and my wife was there and my mum and dad and everything. And we were in the bar afterwards and I had a tap on my shoulder and I turned around, this very tall guy. And I was like, oh my God, Tim. He went, Danny. And I didn't know you could do that. It was great. And he came back twice after that. Yeah.
And I'm right in thinking you could see the audience much more than in because of the way it was.
There was just like a standing area, so you had like you could have 500 people, I think it was, on the floor. So when the whole thing was on platforms, and then by the end, it just sunk to the floor, and then you had this big dance off with the audience, and it was great fun, proper life affirming, yeah.
You mentioned him, Michael Douglas, obviously working with him on the Apple TV show, Franklin. Apple isn't the only streamer you're working with. You've got a little film coming out with a couple of familiar faces on Netflix at the Thursday Murder Club based on...
Never heard of it.
So this is author Richard Osman's hugely popular series of novels about a group of people in an old people's home solving murders. So alongside yourself, Helen Mirren, Pierce Brosnan, Ben Kingsley, Celia Imrie, Rich Lee Grant, David Tennant, Jonathan Pryce.
Brilliant Naomi Aki. She's in it as well. Incredible.
Directed by Chris Columbus. Produced by your old pal Steven Spielberg.
Yes. Yeah, that was... Steven came on a set visit the day I wasn't there. Can you believe it?
Oh, no.
I was so gutted because I'd worked with Steve, on Tintin, which was the motion capture movie. And we did that back in 2009 when, I guess... motion capture was still in its infancy, really. But I remember having a great time with Steven Spielberg. So when I knew Amblin was producing Thursday Murder Club, I was really excited, but I was just gutted I wasn't there. I mean, hopefully I'll meet him at the premiere or something again.
I mean, what a cast. What a cast. Obviously, huge expectations for the film because the books are so popular. I'm guessing you're beyond needing to audition now.
What happened with... the Thursday Murder Club was... My agent's a huge fan of those series. I hadn't read it. I to be honest, I didn't realise how big the books were, and also how big they were in America, and how many of them. I mean, I'm pleased now that there's five of them. You know, so I'm over the moon now. But my agent is saying, "There's well, are we allowed to say who I'm playing in it? Maybe not. No, she said you're particularly right for this role.
Okay,
in the movie. And Sarah, my agent, said, right, you've got to do a self tape because he's seeing eight actors on Monday. You're away, but I want you to be in the mix. And I was like, oh man, I've only just got here. Like, now I've got to read the script, do a self tape. Thankfully, it came my way. And that was the thing. I mean, I was so excited about that cast, but the guy directing it is Chris Columbus, like Home Alone and Gremlins and all this amazing stuff. Harry Potter, yeah. I mean, he said to me on the first rehearsal, he was like, this is the best cast I've had since Harry Potter. And I went, yeah, you screwed that one up, didn't you? but Chris was great because Chris was one of those directors who was just like, if he said to me, maybe you shouldn't have said it, but he said, Danny, if you see a line in the book that you want to incorporate in the scene, just come in and we'll fit it in and we'll work with it. And I was like, that's all you had to say. I was coming in with monologues and everything. great. So those actors were just huge fans of their work, growing up watching them, Helen Mirren and Ben Kingsley and everything. It's just great.
Does it take a lot of confidence? Did you have to say, sorry, Chris Columbus said I was allowed to add some lines, when everyone's looking at you going, yep, are you building your part here?
Well, there was one, there was a lot of sort of editing of the script, like sort of lines were being cut left, right and centre. And I was like, oh, that's a really good line. And I'd had a bit of a break from filming and I had to come back and do this big set two scene with them all. And I thought to myself, well, we said, if you want to add stuff in, I'm going to just put it all back in. So I did. And I was quite nervous because when you do the offer up, like when you do the read through of the scene for the crew and everyone, they went, right, let's just run through the lines. And I said, well, listen, before we start, I've added a few things back in. And they all looked at me and I was like, just hear it out, you know. And Chris was like, fine. And thankfully, I went for it and they all fell about laughing. So Chris was like, it's great, keep it all in. And he said to me, all the line changes have to go through Amblin and Netflix. You turn up and do what you want and it's brilliant. So it's fine.
That's great.
But you want a director like that, right? You want to sort of, you know, have fun with it and play and take a risk. And I haven't seen the edited film yet, so it might not be
it. I've tried my hand at acting very, very briefly. Juice Bigelow, European Gigolo.
Oh, yeah.
I found it really difficult. Right. Like the idea of just pretending to be another character, I was completely, I felt a bit silly. I was like, I could never really escape the fact that it's me pretending to be someone. Mm. Like when you are performing a role, are you completely disappeared into that character, or is there still a part of you there that is being self-referential and almost examining what you're doing?
Yes, but I mean, it feels like a very small voice in your head. You have to, that always has to be there because you're monitoring how the performance is going. Do you know what I mean? If it's on stage or whatever medium it is. But my kids have got into acting a little bit, like my daughter at the moment, and it's, I mean, when we're all kids, we do role play, right? I mean, my daughter used to do role play. We used to do loads of things together and play funny characters. And it's that thing of, sometimes I think acting isn't difficult at all. There's a real kind of simplicity to it, really. Sometimes I think that what I do for a living is just bizarre. It's like make-believe. It's like when you're 5 years old playing role play. And the thing is, they pick you up from your house, they drive you to a location, they give you these clothes to wear, they give you a cup of tea or a coffee, and someone runs off and gets you a breakfast. And I mean, you sit in a makeup chair and you're pampered, and everything is geared to getting you to that mark in front of that camera so you can deliver the goods. But that's the hard bit. Bill Nighy said an amazing thing. He said, they pay you for the half an hour you have in your trailer before you step out and do the scene. That's the moment of anxiety that hits you. Do you know what I mean? Particularly if it's a big project.
Yeah.
It's about being able to conquer those nerves and use those to your advantage, really. But like I said, you can't rest. You're only as good as your last performance.
Any regrets? Any auditions that didn't go well? Anything that you've thought, I messed that one up. I wish I'd got that. Something that went wrong.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I've got loads of auditions that you think. I remember one particular. I can't remember the actual project, but I was so convinced I'd got the part. The casting director even came down, walked down the corridor and pressed the button for the lift. And I was like, this is it. Fantastic. Bing. Shut the doors. Shut them in. Well, I've got that in the bag. And it never came my way. But you can't predict it, no, right. Because it will come down to, I don't know, you're not tall enough or whatever it is. All those factors come into play. But yeah, I've had to cope with rejection. And that's the tough bit about it all. The tough bit is really when you don't get a role that you've worked your ass off trying to get and you think you're tailor-made for it, but it just hasn't, someone's perceived as a bigger name or whatever it is. That those moments where you are, people will say you're never out of work, Danny, but there have been periods where I haven't worked, or there's been periods or moments that I've missed out on roles which I really wanted. But as my old man says, put your armour plate in on and move on, you know. And the more you continue in the profession, that sense of rejection, it's part and parcel of the job. You know, if it's meant for you, it's not going to pass you by. You have to sort of really believe in that.
So as we sit here in the Savoy in 2024, when you look back across your career at this point, especially taking into account what an incredible last 12 months it's been, how do you feel? Do you feel successful?
I feel I want to stay in this room tonight.
Do you feel successful and satisfied creatively?
I never feel like, no, I never feel like you've cracked it. You know, you're a success. That's not part of my makeup, really. It's not. I mean, I'm kind of like my wife would say, put your feet up, relax and see what you've achieved. But there's a hunger in me. I always want to know where the next thing is and what the next challenge will be.
So when you say hunger, it's not like a dissatisfaction with where you are in your career. It's not that drives you forward, because that is the case for a lot of people. A lot of people, it's just like it's not enough and they want more. And
yeah.
That's something that they use to motivate themselves.
Yeah, there was an element of that.
Right.
There's an element of I want to be able to say that I've fulfilled my potential. That's what I want. That's the thing that drives me. And I think to a certain extent, there's still more to come. I haven't necessarily, I don't want to do myself a disservice when I say this, but I haven't had that character which has, you know, smashed through the glass ceiling as such. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong, the people I've worked with and the characters I've played and the projects I've been in have been pinch me, am I dreaming, really? But there's an element of it's been a very long, hard slog, an enjoyable one. But I don't know if you could necessarily think of one character I've played that I'd be synonymous with, you know what I mean? Attached to, like a sort of Phil Glenister and Gene Hunt, I don't know if that character's actually come my way yet, if that makes sense.
So that's still on your bucket list then?
I think so, right. Yeah. There's still more to come, hopefully.
We're nearly out of time, but I do have three quick-fire questions to ask you before we leave. First of all, we've made our way through a tiny portion of your achievements today. What is the thing you are most proud of?
In terms of credits?
Or both?
I would say the thing I'm most proud of is my kids, my wife and kids. I think it's I've been blessed that we're still together, but no, not that. But, you know, I've been able to sort of raise two children in this. The thing is, it's like I guess what I'm most proud of is that I haven't had to do. If you'd have told me that kid leaving drama school, you'd have had this career and you'd have been able to raise a family, two kids, be married and not do another job on the side. That is kind of like an amazing achievement, really. And I'm proud of that. I mean, my wife has been, without Lou in my life, it would be, I wouldn't have been able to have had the career that I've had. She's allowed me to, you know, we know each other so well, and she knows what makes me tick. She knows what I need. She knows the demands of the profession. She was a makeup artist in her own right. That's where we met. So she knows what it takes to be an actor. So I've been blessed that she's been so supportive and an emotional rock for me to sort of cling on to throughout these 20 years. Yeah, over 20 years now.
Okay, next question. Tell me the most valuable skill that you've ever learned, the one that changed your way of doing things.
The moonwalk.
I love that.
The moonwalk, that is a skill in its own sense. Yeah, yeah. I mean, God, the things you learn, yeah. I was going to say playing golf. I mean, you need a lot of skill to play golf. That's the only one thing I can, in terms of sport that I play now, other than run and go to the gym, because the football days are done. My legs aren't, I can't do that anymore. I love that. I love having a round of golf because I like the sociable aspect of it as well. Walking around, having a, trying to hit this little white ball, but also having great company around you.
Okay.
An acting skill. Well, all of the dialects that you've seemed to pick up over the years. I mean, that in itself is a great skill to have.
Final question. Can you give us one piece of advice that you would give to someone else wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Be bold, be brave. Listen to the fire that's burning within you. I always say to any young actor, you've got to have this sense that you can't do anything else in this world. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a real fire that can't be put out. It's the passion and the fire that burns inside of you. You've got to hold on to that because that's your talent, because it's a precious thing. Hold on to it, nurture it, and allow it to flourish and see where it takes you.
Daniel Mays, that is us done. Thank you so
much,
Alex, for your time.
Chin, chin.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Lovely. Tell me you press record.
And that is it. Thank you to our producer, Lauren Armstrong-Carter at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Lauren Perrier, and of course, to Mr. Daniel Mays for coming in today. We'll be opening the Savoy's Little Black Book again soon to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye for now.